I'm Matthew McCabe. Welcome to Miracle Voices. Each episode, we will be delving into stories of forgiveness, healing, and transformation that have come about from integrating the principles of the book, A Course in Miracles. If you want to learn more about A Course in Miracles, visit www.acim.org. If you'd like to visit the Miracle Voices site, please go to www.miraclevoices.org. If you feel inspired to make a love offering, please visit us at miraclevoices.org/donate. All donations go to support the work of the Foundation for Inner Peace, the publisher of A Course in Miracles. Now here's your program. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Miracle Voices. This is your co-host, Matt McCabe. I'm here with my co-host, Tam Morgan. Tam, how you doing today?
I am doing today. I'm trying not to doing so much, but here we are.
We're being good.
This is a good one.
Good.
This is a good doing.
And our guest today is Leon Russell. Leon, how are you?
Yay! Guys, I'm so good. Yeah, I am still as God created me. And really, really pleased to be connected with both of you. I've got a great deal of love for you. And I've probably listened to nearly all of the podcasts in this series since Matt, you and Judy started them. And yeah, you've brought me loads and loads of joy. It's really lovely. And I will say, and I'm experiencing it now, so I can say it with a little bit more oomph. Just your silence. There's a real presence to your silence. You can really tell that you're both intently listening. So there's a bit of feedback for you on what you do. It's beautiful.
That's funny. Feedback and silence all at once. Spoken from a musician point of view.
Yeah. And Leon, where are you in the world?
I am on the south coast of England in a beautiful city called Brighton. It's a really creative city. It's a colourful place. Everybody's not tolerated. It's everybody's got a place here. It's one of these sort of cities that attracts people from the backwaters and they think, oh, this is my tribe. And that's been going on for decades. And now it's populated by really colourful people from all walks of life and very safe place. You know, it's really nice and creative and it's lovely. But I will tell you that as soon as Matt found out I was in a seaside town on the south coast of England, he was desperate for me to FedEx him some mushy peas.
Yes. Yes. I know Brighton has really good chippers, fish and chip places, and they put the like mashed peas and served on the side too.
Uh-oh. We're going to the end of the podcast.
Yeah, like you can see how easy I'm triggered into a comfort food. It doesn't take much.
Okay, we'll just play this one backwards.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, step away from the comfort foods, Matt. Step away. Okay. Leon, why don't you tell us how A Course in Miracles came into your life?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I think around the age of 14, I kind of like realized that my awareness was kind of like above listening to these voices, you know, as in what we know to be the Holy Spirit or the ego. And I kind of like stopped and I thought to myself, what is this situation? You know, what's going on here? What is the awareness? What am I listening to? And I think it sort of began an external investigation into literature and religious studies and philosophy. And my mum had a really good collection of books, which was ace. So I was able to look through those. But I kept coming up against a stumbling block whenever I found one of these kind of quote unorganized religions that were saying, follow our way and just our way. And if you don't do this, you're not getting in. And it used to really turn me off and I'm like, oh, okay. And I'd shut the book and like move on. And then I'd look at something else and look at something else. And then I guess you sort of scroll forward 5 or 6 years and I moved out of my family home and we lived at number 25 in this road. And I actually only moved to number 44. So it was a small step, but it was a huge step because when I moved down there, my next door neighbor had a book called A Course in Miracles, and I looked at it and I opened it up, and obviously, as the same that happens to lots and lots of people, is we're hit by the introduction. Something really powerful speaks to us in the introduction, And for me, when it said what's all encompassing can have no opposite, it's kind of like that's what I'd been looking for. I'd been looking for an all inclusive sort of concept that there was no exclusion to anybody. It's like that spoke to me. So I said, can I borrow this book? And I took it next door to my place, and I obviously kept it for too long, because a week or so later he knocked on the door and he had a brand new copy of A Course in Miracles in his hands, and he's like, ah, I've got you something. And he gave it to me, and we had to do an exchange. I had to give him his back, funnily enough. And he was a really lovely man. He's still my friend to this day. That was in 1993. And he's got a smile like a Cheshire cat. He kind of like looks like almost the energy that Stevie Wonder gives off when he's just in his joy at the piano, and we see his big beaming smile. And he was really terrified about me moving in next door to him, because I was a rock musician in like a power trio, and he was having this lovely time with like a beautiful wild garden at the back of the property, and everything was really mellow. And he was like, uh-oh, who's this guy who's going to move in here and change the vibe? And actually, also, he'd been pulled over by the police once, and that was for driving too slow, just to give you an idea. Literally a 20-mile tailback. And he was probably listening to Van Morrison and, you know, just jogging along. So, yeah, he was worried about me moving in, but we actually really hit it off. And to this day, he's, yeah, one of the most important people in my life. And it was what I was looking for. You know, at that time, I was kind of like offering advice to friends. They'd come to me, and then I would feel good about the fact that there was something of value in what I could share with them, but then I would still have maybe a temper tantrum, or I'd get angry, or there'd be something happen within a day or two, and then I just couldn't reconcile what was going on. And once the course showed me that this voice, this ego identity, and kind of positioned it in a way where I didn't have to consider that it was my identity or my full being, if you like, the freedom that came from that was just incredible, really. And then for the next 27 years, strangely, it was a really solitary experience. I think I should have drawn a little red smiley face on the front of the course and called it Wilson, because the two of us were cast away. And, you know, I literally had four other people in that time who I ever bumped into and met who had the course. And during lockdown, I had this idea of like, oh, I'll tell you what, I'm going to Google Course in Miracles. Because, you know, it just was like, I almost never conceived of the fact that anybody else would have a copy or they'd be into it. Obviously, on the back of my copy, it said we'd sold 500,000 copies since 1976. So I knew people were out there, but I'd never met anyone. And I Googled Course in Miracles, and holy smokes, there's like all this stuff out there. And I found a really beautiful teacher on YouTube and watched her for a while. And then she guided me through the workbook for a couple of years. And I haven't stopped. I'm on lesson 924 today. And I won't stop. Janet Weissman, she's called. She's like, if you imagine a young girl woke up in the morning and opened the curtains on a ranch and looked out on the meadow and found maybe 20 unicorns out there, and someone said, oh, these unicorns need somebody to stroke them and brush their manes. And that's the kind of infectious enthusiasm she has for the course. It's just joy upon joy. And that was a wonderful experience. And then I found a certain gentleman called Ken Wapnick, who in our household gets called Ken Pacino. Because my wife came in one day and she said, why is Al Pacino talking about A Course in Miracles? And I said, no, that's Ken Pacino. That's Ken Wapnick. So he's now known as Ken Pacino in the household. And then I started to integrate with a few different communities online, not all positive, to be honest. And it was quite a surprise. I was taken aback of a group that I was in, and some people were really anti-Ken, and I was like, really? Okay, what's going on here? And I I was getting a bit tired of it. And I kind of like the some of the posts were like, well, you know, if you're triggered by this, that's your ego reacting to their ego. And it's like, okay, I get that. You know, it's all illusion and there's no order of reality to illusions. But, you know, I could say sewage is an illusion, but it doesn't mean I'm going to put it on my toast in the morning and have it for breakfast. It's like we don't have to just engage with these things for the sake of it. And I contacted the admin and sort of said, can we not like stop this? And they were like, no, we let it all play out. So I sort of, and strangely, I left this group and I felt so much better to get away from those people. And that was so strange because it's like, you guys are course students and this just doesn't compute in my brain, you know? And then I kind of went almost solitary again, but then found a couple of other groups since, Keith Kavanagh, which you guys have done.
Yeah,
beautiful podcast. You guys, I've listened to that about three times.
That's so beautiful.
So good. His community, man, they're just like lovely people. It's all really gentle and supportive, and Keith's like a font of course knowledge. He loves Ken, and it was like shoulders dropped for me of like, there's my tribe, you know. And I've been lucky to find a couple of foundation based groups on Facebook and stuff as well. Tam, I would like to say, whoever's running all the social stuff for foundation, it's absolutely brilliant. I love the quality of the videos and the construct and the format. It's really 2023.
Thank you. It's been an evolution, and we don't have one person running it, but we have a bunch. And I hear that you're in touch with Laura Fenimore, and her hand is very much in that.
Oh, Laura's become a really good friend really quickly. We speak most days.
Yeah.
Lovely. I love her.
Yeah, same.
Well, Leon.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good time to hear about your forgiveness story. I'd love to hear.
Maybe.
Maybe. No, we don't know. We'll never have a definitive answer if it was the best time. But it seems like one possible good time.
Yeah. Only if we don't talk about comfort food and sidetrack you.
I'll place my forgiveness story in the hands of God.
I think you already have.
Yeah.
That's redundant.
So, my dad is my subject for my forgiveness story. And bless him, he's not with us anymore. And he had a really, really difficult life. And there was a lot of stuff that happened to him which distorted his frequency and kind of like there was conditionings which just set his path out in a way that maybe for him there wasn't any other options as to how to live and how to behave. He was, as a young boy, really strange as it might sound. All he did was kick a bucket into a canal, and he was spotted by a local policeman. And as a result of that, that was apparently enough reason to be sent away to like a borstal, like a children's home. And he was one of seven children. He was the third one born, and he had two elder brothers, two younger sisters, and two younger brothers. So I imagine for like a young boy to be sent away to an institution and to not be able to make sense and process why he'd been singled out from his siblings to have this experience was the beginning of the path that he got set upon, really. And when he became like maybe a teenager, late teens, and a man in his own right, he met my mum, and she, strangely, was one of seven, the third born, two older brothers, two younger brothers, two younger sisters. And she'd been sent away. She had a baby before she was 16, and she got sent away to have this baby from her family. And then the two of them met, and they come together, obviously, with their quite unique experiences, but identical shared experience as well, of knowing what it felt like to be ostracized from a big family unit. And I guess in those times, the dad, my grandfather, in both families was out working to feed nine mouths. And my grandmothers were both looking after the home, feeding everybody, dressing everyone. And what happened with the children, from how I've had these stories relayed to me, is they loved one another in a sense of the tactile interactions, and the parents were almost like doing the jobs of keeping everybody afloat. So for them to find one another, there was obviously a real sense of them coming home to one another and a chance to start again. And then my dad was interested in drugs back then. This is kind of like the late 60s. And his social background was that there was like the pubs, the places where the people were drinking near him. The pub was known as the Blood Tub. And that gives you an idea to the sort of activities that would be going on there. There'd be people just fighting pretty much most nights. It was like a spit and sawdust kind of setup. And I think he told me that they didn't even bother having windows. They just used to put metal sheets up at the end of the night because they knew someone would throw like a bar stool through the window during the duration of the evening. And he was of this new generation of peace and love who thought if they smoked cannabis, they could change the minds of everyone and we could all raise our vibrations to one of some sort of harmonious, loving state and cure the world of all of its ills. But then he got involved also in wanting to sell and deal in the drugs, and that took him off to prison. So I'd been born and my mum was like, I'm keeping this baby. No one's taking this baby from me. So her and my dad started off with me, and then my dad went and put himself in exactly the same situation as his childhood, where he's now out the loop. He's away. My mum and myself obviously accelerated our connection over a year or so, and by the time he's come back to the family unit, he's an outsider again. And during that time, I'd experienced like some bullying from the boy next door, who was quite a bit younger than his siblings, and he could sort of see that me and my mum had something good going on. You know, I understand many years later that he was basically wanting what we had, and he wasn't getting it in his home environment, so therefore he wanted to take it out on me by bullying. So the outside of my home was like a place that I didn't feel safe. There was terror and there was threat of what would get done to me if my parents weren't, or if my mum wasn't around. And then my dad came home, and I think really he sort of brought the terror then to the inside of the house, because again he carried on with his drug taking and his drug dealing, and there was an incident where the police turned up at the house and raided the place, and I wasn't in bed even though it's quite late at night, and I experienced this 100%, like I could relay it word for moment by moment now. That was like 45 years ago, and it was such a strong impression that it made the inside of the home as more terrifying as the outside. So there's a series of his choices already from like me being a small child, where it's like they're affecting my ability to be at peace and to enjoy life right from the get-go, off the bat, really. And the place wasn't particularly somewhere where I felt safe. I was obviously wet in the bed because I was like whatever lid I managed to put on top of my fears during my waking hours. Then obviously when I went to sleep, who knows what sort of night terrors were happening, but by the time I got up pretty much every day for years, you know, it's just like wet the bed. So that comes with all sorts of shame and things attached to that, and guilt of not wanting to be that person and to have that effect on, like, even so, you're not wanting my mum to be washing the sheets all the time. So, you know, things had got pretty sort of stuck in a rut in that house. And then we managed to move to a new place. And there was, I remember all the excitement and all the promise that was attached to this new building. And it was really beautiful. It had lots of stained glass and it had leaded windows and it had a side garden and a back garden and a front garden. It was like, wow, you know, this is going to change things for us. But he carried on doing what he was doing, and I was old enough now to start overhearing what he was saying, and I realized that he'd said the police were watching the house. And again, so the terror came with us, and the anxiety and the threat for the future. I was always like thinking, oh my God, you know, anything could happen any moment. And interestingly, as an adult, when I look back at that time, I'd developed like a huge passion for playing with Lego. And I had a huge town, like probably 2 square meter sort of Lego town with all these little houses and cars and people. And I realized that I used that play as a way of processing what was going on for me, because I could control this tiny little world. And I used to have a cycle of play that involved a point where I'd round up all the police and I'd move them and take them and probably put them in like another bedroom, and I'd say, right, the police have gone on holiday now. And then I would let the place become like a dystopian, lawless, chaotic place where all of the order that I'd thrived upon whilst I was controlling this environment was all just put aside for a little while I just let it all play out. And, you know, I'd watched maybe like the first Mad Max movies and things by then. So it was, there was a part of that involved in it. And then obviously when I felt like I'd got that out of my system and the whole town was in disarray, then I'd say, right, the police are coming back from their holiday now, and I'd go and get them. And then everybody had to go back to their designated buildings and have their designated cars, and everything would get fixed. And yeah, I see how I was like playing out this control and out of control sort of loop of trying to work out what was going on, really. And my dad was like, made me very aware of the fact that the police were our enemy, and we needed to be afraid of them, and that they would get me. One of his favorite lines was, they'd get you to get to me, you know. And I was a young lad thinking, what, those people who kicked all the doors in and came screaming and shouting and took you away, they're going to come for me, you know, I haven't done anything. And also there's this sort of subterfuge of being told what's going on needs to be kept under wraps, we can't let other people know what we're doing. So there was loads and loads of layers to the stuff while he was interested in the cannabis. And then he went to prison again. And, you know, I can remember when we used to have to go to visit and how strange it was. Like, you know, a lot of people know that, say, like if you've got a pet and the pet spots you getting ready and dressed to go out, then you can see your dog going, uh-oh, you're going, am I coming, you know. And they sense all of the vibration of the event that they think's coming. And in a sense, I can remember that with my mum, seeing her getting ready at the mirror and putting the clothes on for us to then go on one of these strange journeys of buses and trains to go to this building, which the architecture, the psychology of the architecture when you're a small child is even more striking than when you understand it as an adult, you know, great big tall doors with men who look really stern, all dressed in black with big bunches of keys, and you can feel that they're kind of judging you because you're associated the person who's locked up in the prison for doing something that's against the law. And we go through all these different rooms, waiting rooms, and eventually find my dad in some room somewhere, either chained to a table or sometimes he'd be behind a sheet of glass with the telephone. So, you know, it's a lot of stuff to try and process and to understand. And it felt like losing him time and time again, because there was no way of like understanding, oh, no, he'll be back in 18 months, or he'll be back in a year, or you'll see him again in six. Just didn't know any of that sort of stuff. So, you know, I'd lost him many times, really. And then in one of his prison stays, he was introduced to heroin. And that sort of took things to a whole new level. So when he came home, he was then like a heroin addict. And it was at an age of, for me, where it was still, you know, still all of the terror was completely sort of ruling my life, really. And he would say things like, oh, don't tell your mum you've seen me doing this. And in society's sense, we hadn't seen the waves of negativity that were going to come from this drug use. We didn't realize we hadn't had the generation of casualties. So it's not like a recreational thing, as we know. It's like, oh, I'll just do some heroin, you know, 3 or 4 days on the bounce. It's like, no, you don't get to make that choice. It's going to be your habit if you do it more than once or twice, as far as I'm aware. So that changed him as a person, obviously, massively. And we all went as a family down to a fireworks night one night. And then when we came home from the fireworks, the back door was ajar, and we come into the house and the house had been burgled. So again, it's like there's another form of threat out there to add to the terror. And then I remember, like, I was so scared of leaving the living room of an evening if we were all sitting in there watching television. And I'd started to, like, visualize like a lumberjack at the top of the stairs, like a big 6-foot by 6-foot giant with a great big gray beard and a checkered shirt and braces and a huge axe. And I was terrified to leave the lounge because it's like, poof, okay. So in a sense, that would then stop me going and popping to the toilet and having a pee. And then by the time I've gone to bed, I've probably got a full bladder, and it's sort of like perpetuate the fact that I'm going to wet the bed again. So it kept all of that going. And then we found out that it was my dad who'd actually burgled the house. He'd obviously wanted to try and get some money for his drug habit, and he wanted to sell the stuff that he'd pretended to steal and get the insurance money. And then my mum started to realize the extent of, like, what this drug addiction does to you. And she tried 2 or 3 times to sort of shut the world away and lock him in the house. And literally, if it went on for a month, the day that he went outside again, he would just, like, race to wherever he was getting it from, and he'd jump back on the wagon with it. So it really did come to a point where it was like, you know, Einstein says, doesn't he, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So I think my mum came to that one day when she'd taken off a piece of jewellery to do the washing up. Not particularly expensive jewellery, but it was something that had a sentimental value, and she couldn't find it. And she asked him, and he made such a over-exaggerated song and dance about helping her look for it that she just thought, oh my God, you've taken it, haven't you? She knew he was just covering up. And she just said, look, I don't know what you've done with it, where it is, but just get it back. And like the next day or something, it was back. And it was like, this is how ill you've got now. This is like you're burglaring your own home. You're stealing from your wife. And it just couldn't go anywhere, you know. It just really, really come to a grinding halt, to the point where she just had to say, I need to protect the boys. We need to move away. I had a younger brother by then. It was getting to the point where the local police, if I was out with my friends, I remember them saying, right, where are you boys all from? And me giving my surname and my address, and them going, what number house? And it's like my number was being flagged now. And it's like, well, I haven't done anything. So all of these things were perpetuating this terror and this guilt by association. And we were part of like a big family. As I said, both my mum and dad had 1 of 7, were 1 of 7. So I had loads of cousins, loads of aunties and uncles, grandparents. I've had friends at school and neighbours, the familiarity. And we had to leave all of that behind and just get away from this person. We literally travelled like a few hundred miles from the north of England down to the south coast. My mum had an old school friend, and we stayed in one room in her house. Initially, they told us that Dad would be following, and he was just going to sell the house. And, you know, they obviously did that to try and soften the transition. And then we started off again. It was like the three of us in one bedroom. And then we moved into what's called like a bed and breakfast over here. And then we got a one bedroom flat where we're all staying together. And occasionally I'd hear from Dad, you know, he never managed to maintain a regular contact. He would like go silent for a long time, and then one night you'd get a phone call really late, and he'd be obviously drunk, and he'd had enough alcohol to sort of feel like he could face this situation. and all of his drug taking, you know, there's a lot of like regrets in his life that he was covering up. We know that heroin's like it's like an emotional kind of security blanket that somebody can pull all the way up to their chin and hide all of those feelings away for a number of hours and not have to face all of the things that they feel that they need to deal with if they're honest with themselves. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff that kind of he did to other people, which I don't feel is my responsibility or my place to be able to bring those details to the table. But there's a couple of times where, you know, we didn't speak for a while because I was just did not know how to deal with this man. You know, he was really manipulative, and emotional blackmail was really intense. He understood what a sensitive person I was and how to press the buttons so that my heart would go out to him. I remember from the age of like 21 years old, he told me he had 6 months to live. And he was using everything in his power to try and kind of lever some extra sort of feeling out of the situation, which I understand because of what had happened to him as a young boy and how hard that must have been to compute, and how it like defined him, this crazy little moment where he kicked a bucket in the canal and it set him on this entire path. And I was speaking to Matt about this in the build-up today, and it took a long, long time for me to make the differentiation between his identity and him as a person from his behavior. And that was the key for me, really, because it was practically impossible, or I wouldn't recommend that somebody tries to close down the channel of love between anyone, let alone between like a child and a parent. You need to keep that open because that's natural connection. But it was very, very difficult to keep that open because of everything that he'd done and because of the way that he'd done things to affect me and kind of define me as a person, really, for a long, long time, until I shook off that stuff. And you know, the forgiveness aspect is key to it all, really, because in eventually I was able to differentiate him from his behavior. And I often use like a metaphor of saying, you know, imagine you arrive in a room and there's a load of spaghetti that's been cooked. Sorry to trigger the foodie and Matt here, but this part of the metaphor. So there's loads of spaghetti on the side and it's all laid out in neat lines. It's like a regular interval between it. And there's like, I don't know, let's say there's a 3 or 4 square meters of it all. And you look at it and go, wow, look at that, all neat and organized. And it's like, yeah, but a minute ago that was all in a huge bowl and it was all completely tangled up. And it's taken ages and ages to pick each single piece out and lay it out like it is so that you can now see it like that. So there's been a massive amount of work involved in being able to reach this perspective. But that work has been what's helped me to become who I am, really. And it's quite easy for me now to think of it as a gift and to think everything that he put us through helped me to find out what I'm capable of. So I have a phrase that somewhere I've come up with, which is our capacity to overcome is the yardstick by which we can measure our inner strength. And my dad gave me this opportunity. He showed me what special relationships were up very, very close. He showed me all sorts of ego behavior, like a living visual example of what all of these behaviors were like. He gave me the perfect opportunity to learn how to forgive and to forget the past. He's given me the opportunity to not be fearful about the future. And all these things have led me to the point where my faith and A Course in Miracles is the thing that just resonates with me so powerfully. And had I not had these experiences, then I probably wouldn't have come to this place. And in a similar sense to how I processed stuff through play as a child with Lego, as a teenager, I discovered music And, you know, that was like 35 years ago now. And I've just spent so many years as a musician playing concerts and releasing records. And my course understanding is what I use to write my lyrics. And interestingly, I was working with a chap recently and he said to me, "Oh, you're in a band?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah." And I told him the band's called Warm Rain. I was like, "One word, Warm Rain." And he looked it up on Spotify and he said, is it this one? And I looked at it and I went, "Yeah, it's that." And I was like, "Hey?" And I looked at it, showed me like the top five tracks that people like. And I did a little bit of math and I'm like, there's 60,000 hits on that. Okay. And then I jumped on YouTube and I looked at that and it's like, there's 120,000. There's like, and I'm thinking, there's 200,000 people just off the bat without looking at all the other platforms that our music's available on and people who've bought CDs and come to concerts. And they've all been like deeply touched by this music, which is essentially Course in Miracles inspired music, whether they know it or not. And, you know, I'm very much a team player. So if you'd have said to me, I know, Tam, I've heard you talk to people about soul contracts a lot. I know that's part of your vocabulary. So if someone had said to me, Leon, it's part of your soul contract to go through like 30, 40 years of like really, really difficult stuff that's going to pull you left, right and center. But at the end of it, you're going to be able to speak from such a place of authenticity that when you write this music that helps you to process what you've been through, other people will pick up on that frequency of truth and it will help them to heal. I'd have just very simply gone, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And, you know, I think of Jesus, if I said to you, Jesus and his disciples, the first disciple that always comes to mind is Judas. And the reason we think of Judas first is because we know the story. And what did Jesus say to Judas? He just said, "Friend, do what you came here to do." It's like, and I feel like that about my dad, you know, it's like, do what you came here to do. It's like you put me through all of this stuff, but it showed me what I'm capable of. It showed me that I'm worth having around in a crisis. Now I've got something to offer. And some of the messages that I've had from people from all over the world regarding the Warm Rain stuff literally, you know, brought me to a grinding halt of just like how people say, this is the best song I've ever heard in my life. I wish this song was on the radio once an hour. Or, you know, my dad was dying and he had dementia and now this song reminds me of the time we spent together. It's like if someone gave me like an Oscar version in the music industry and said, there you go, there's your Grammy, and it was made of solid gold, I'd probably say, melt that down and turn it into small pieces of gold, give it to the poor. And I'm all right, thank you, because, you know, there's nothing that could come close to the payment, the feeling of return that you get when people come to you in a vulnerable state and say, what you've created has made my life better.
Mm-hmm. And so oddly and ironically, what your dad created has made your life better.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really absolutely beautiful. One of the themes in this that I hear is this feeling, and it can be so confusing, of what you do around someone you love who is being self-destructive. Mm. And everyone's affected by it. And you started it, I mean, from what you even said about looking for course groups, and some did not really, you weren't gravitating towards the attitudes in it. And we don't know that they were difficult or not led. Well, it doesn't even matter. It's just, who do you want your company to be? And so the same was with your dad. Like, there was all this love, but there were times you had to separate in order to find your way and your peace, even though he knew how to keep pulling you back in. And I had a friend, you know, similar to what you said about, you know, God is in everything. And this friend of mine said, God, we are all one and God is everything. But I find that some people are like God's butthole and I just don't want to hang around that part of God. And
Nice.
So the freedom we have to pick and choose. I mean, some people want to be around God's butthole and they gravitate to others like that, it seems. And, you know, it's all processing through the stuff. But your path in really getting to see the difference between someone's behavior and who they really are, and then the next step of who they really are for you. And that is just a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing it. It's really inspiring. And how did your dad, and when did he pass?
2019. Yeah, he lived a long, long time. He found a way out of taking the heroin, and that was replaced by alcohol for a long time. But eventually his health and sort of living situations in terms of who he ended up living with, he wasn't able to get to either the store or the person who would give him the things that were distorting him. I don't know if he found his peace. Ironically, you know, he always had the Bible, even though that's not my book. It doesn't speak to me. I realize that it does for some people, or lots of people probably, but you know, that was a sticking point, because it's like somebody almost reciting a technical manual as such to you, but then not living it. It's like, well, my hypocrite radar is flagging here.
Well, also interesting that he ended up with alcohol, which was the one thing he was preaching against in the beginning.
Absolutely.
And then he fell into being stuck by the company he kept, which couldn't get him out completely into a different kind of behavior and choice. Mm. So to really realize that we do have the freedom of choice in one way to not stay in that kind of company, it's really hard to remember when it seems to be all you have. And you have to have the conscious awareness.
Absolutely. And it's kind of forced on, you know, it's kind of forced on you in a sense of like the duty of family. It was a very difficult decision for me to cut my dad out of my life at certain points, because he's my dad and my family. But, you know, I just had to learn about like protecting myself for a little while. And you know, there's been 45 years of working on myself. I'm still working on myself every single day with a Course in Miracles material. I've been to different therapies. I've had NLP. My wife's been hugely inspirational to me on that front. And, I've had to work through my dreams. So for a long time, I would always have dreams of the home being threatened, obviously. And weirdly, I was listening to you, or not weirdly, but I was listening to you talking to someone recently about, you know, the text and the workbook needing to run concurrently. You know, you can't do one without the other. And for me, the workbook was something that I, you know, for those 27 years when I was cast away with Wilson, it's like I didn't really do the workbook. I was just text. I read, come back to it. And now, like I said, I'm on lesson 924, and probably, like, I reckon within the last 50 lessons, it's really just like landed. Like, I've gone from sitting there with my eyes closed going, okay, right, let's do the thing, like, and then like one day it just went, and I was like, there is the peace. This is what I've been trying for, you know. And this is like in an age of instant gratification where everybody wants stuff in the same moment that they think of it. And to spend like 2.5 years going, no, come on. And then now it's actually kicked in. It's just like, oh my God, this peace. And then you see the peace seeped into my dreams. And I started to have dreams where the house was safe. And
oh, yay.
Honestly, yeah. So, you know, that's like a real sign of how deep this piece is starting to reach. And my wife's like a psychic. She does QHHT as well, the Dolores Cannon work. And she had a situation where she had some contact with my dad in spirit, and she was like, said to me afterwards, God, he was difficult, and did he always take the limelight? And I was like, God, he did, didn't he? You know, and I realized that I used to shrink back in a way of like trying to let him be who he was. And that was so buried. And I went to a training course in December, and there was about 14 students on this course. And I noticed that when somebody took the lid off the water bottle and just poured the water into the glass, I was like so triggered. And I went back to my room in the evening. I was thinking, what on earth is that about? Why do you care how somebody is pouring water? And then I noticed the next day that when I poured water, I took the lid off without like making a sound. I turned the glass on an angle. I did it without making any evidence that I was even alive or in the room. And, you know, from like 45 years later, after the first major trauma, for me to be able to go with my wife's help to go, that's still this learnt behavior of like, how do I keep myself small and reduced and have no effect? And it's like, there's a lot of work to do. And because there's no degrees with the course material, because there's no such thing as small upsets, you know, once you get past the big stuff, which is blatant, it doesn't mean that then when you get your subatomic microscope, you find the stuff that's really buried in your unconscious mind. That's still as like a bigger deal as finding the big stuff, because it needs to all be ironed out.
Well, I just want to say you actually can just do the workbook without the text or the text without the workbook, but they really were made for partnership because they inform one another so much. And so to think, oh, I just did, you know, the workbook without its companion guide, which is the text, that's fine. But there's just deeper to go. There's if one chooses, you know, applying the course is everything. So the workbook in that way, you know, if you do one lesson correctly, you're there. but good luck with that, because it's going to bring in all the rest and it will probably lead you to the text. So I don't want anyone to feel bad if they're just doing the workbook.
That's really,
it's a fabulous place to begin and to land even. But thank you for that. And also, do you have any children?
No, I've never wanted to be a parent because I was a musician and, oh, well, I'm a musician because touring and playing, I didn't want to be an absent father like my dad was. So I was very conscious to make that decision. But I do have a small sausage dog sitting on my lap at the moment who's crawling away.
Mighty companion.
Yeah. And last thing, just for our listeners, because you've referred to it a few times, and I know exactly to what you're referring when you say alone with Wilson, and other people do not. So just explain in a sentence what that means. It would probably be appreciated, or we'll get a lot of mail about it.
Amazing. Yeah. So there's a good film, a really nice film with Tom Hanks, where he gets lost on an island and people think that he's never coming back. They think he's passed in a plane crash, but he's not. He's made a life for himself in the middle of nowhere. And for company, he gets a coconut one day and he finds something that he can use as a red ink. And he draws a little smiley face on this coconut and he calls it Wilson. And that's his companion during this time while he's living this solitary existence. So, nice one for flagging that up. Otherwise, it's A Course in Wilson.
Really? Matt, I'm sorry I've stepped in a lock. You go. Your turn.
Okay. You know, Leon, that was excellent share there. Tell me, do you ever get to the point all the way back in the course where it talks about what I thought my brother did has not occurred? That's what forgiveness is. When you look at this relationship with your father, how do you reconcile? I had this experience and then I want to take a look at this from witness consciousness and see this hasn't occurred. This is a dream, even though it seems so real. How do you reconcile those things and think about it?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like I've already sort of mentioned in a sense. It's like, you know, I now think that I'm grateful for that experience because of the subject matters that I talk about. I can talk about with such authenticity in my art. And obviously when you sing in people, there's nowhere to hide from someone's voice. You know, there's a podcaster, Danica Patrick, who I really love. And she said one day, do you think truth has a frequency, to one of her guests? And it just landed like a bomb in my mind. I was like, wow, truth has a frequency. Like, yes, yes. You know, you're on it there. That's amazing. So I guess that, you know, like I said, with the Jesus quote to Judas, do what you're here to do, my friend. It's like, I kind of like realize that, I suppose as well, you know, with the soul contract thing, I sometimes explain it to people and say, imagine you haven't incarnated and someone says, right, say it's me. And I say, Matt, I want to live this life where I have this incredible sense of terror for like decades and it defines me and it's absolutely paralyzing. It's horrible. But when I come out of it, the other side, I'm going to have such a strength and such a value to everybody that, you know, my place in the sonship is going to be like, you know, really, really beneficial. But I need somebody who's going to play that role for me. And you could have like a whole bunch of people, even if you think of this in human terms, you could have a whole bunch of people go, well, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want you thinking of me like that, you know, because, you know, that sounds horrible. But the person who holds their hands up and goes, okay, I'll do that. You know, the Judas, all right, I'll do that. I'll betray you. But that one is like, man, you know, that's a big thing to do for someone in terms of a gift. It's like,
yeah, yeah. Well said.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, good.
I did want to ask too about in the lyrics. You mentioned, you know, there's Course in Miracles themes in your lyrics. Is there one in particular that sticks out where people mention it that you're like, hey, that one in particular is like a Course in Miracles theme that seems to be resonating?
Well, this is interesting because, like I said to you earlier, I've like surreptitiously imbued the lyrics with my Course in Miracles love. And I've written like a concept album, which again is part of my healing. So there's a story that gets told over 14 songs, and it's the journey of me back to my youthful self and finding the equilibrium and balancing everything out. And funnily enough, the catalyst for that journey is the loss of my hero. So I sort of took my specific journey and made it a bit more universal so that it would appeal to more people. But there's two phases of it. There's the loss and the gain. And I've learned to write about love in such a way that it's interpretable on many different levels rather than pin it down to one relationship. And I've always known that I was writing about love in the way that I did, with my love of the Course and love of God and love of Christ consciousness and my brothers. And I think people resonate to a song called Absent Friends because it is just so poignant, you know, in terms of the loss at that end of the story, the beginning of the story. And then in terms of the gain, there's a track called Luminous Star, or there's a track called Flying Dreams, where the love and the joy of the kind of success. So, you know, this was a creative project that I held in my mind for 25 years. It took me 10 years to write it, 5 or 6 years to record it. And for a long time during the writing process, I looked back and I realized that I couldn't finish it because I hadn't lived it. And once I'd lived it and found the peace and the joy, then I knew how the ending should go.
Very interesting. We haven't had that many musicians really on the podcast. So it's interesting to hear that kind of as the medium or the canvas for which you're experiencing a lot of the forgiveness in your life.
Yeah, it's play. You know, it's like I said with the Lego. It's like now I realize that at 14, when I found music, it became a way that I play and I process. And obviously everybody's got value in where they fit in the spectrum. And if someone just wants to sing a song that someone else could define as like throwaway subject, or it's just not got depth or whatever, then that's up to them. But everything's of equal value. Whereas for me, it has to be something that I want to do, and it has to speak about something that's really important. So it's been the way that I've been able to look back at my evolution. And interestingly, actually, the reason Laura and I are such good friends now is because I've been asked to do a Course in Miracles article for an online magazine, and I wanted to contact the foundation and say, please, could you tell me the correct way to quote the material directly and the legal requirements and blah, blah, blah. And it's the same principle. I wrote this article. I stood on the doorstep here one morning looking at the clouds, having a cup of coffee, and the Holy Spirit, clear as day, just went, this is just the start. And I was like, oh, hold on a minute. And it's like someone had presented me with a context where I could speak about my understanding of course material without it being cloaked in the music, and without me trying to find an ambiguity and a universal kind of interpretive medium for how it would come across. And it's just to say, look, this is about the Course in Miracles, you know, and just like, oh wow, brilliant. And it was lovely to write this article, because I had to sit down, I had to think, right, I need to plan it from the start to the end, work out what I'm going to say through the sequences. I need people to like, it was also like an introduction for people who knew nothing about it. So I had to say how it's come about, what it means to me, da, da, da. And that same kind of process has happened, that happened in music. And then since I've decided to step out, and now I do like just started doing a Course in Miracles podcast, I've lined up all my social channels to reinforce that podcast. I've got people contacting me on different platforms because they felt guided to, and I'm sort of talking to certain people about their journey with the course, and it's like, oh man, this feels so good. And it's really been very quick. It's just like instantly I'm in the flow, and I'm carried by the good energy of like, yep, help with this mission of like bringing the light back into the awareness of the people who can't see it at the moment. But instead of having to do it, like I say, with the music and tentatively step, because you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about God, or they don't want to think about it. But if you present it to them in a human way, you're getting through to them without them realizing it. And that was a big part of the songwriting within the band sort of music. And now, like I say, to also have concurrently running along with that, the ability to speak openly about course material and just go, like in a podcast I did the other day, I sort of said, you know, it feels like going to an AA meeting and go, my name's Leon and I love God, you know, and everyone, hi Leon.
Yeah. Well, Leon, what do you do when you get in a big ego storm or ego attack, and you get all this stuff that you've learned and internalized seems to go out the window, and it's like you're a rage machine and it's hard to get recentered? Anything you do in that in position?
Well, obviously I'm so advanced and spiritually adept that I wouldn't possibly have an ego storm. So
my hypocrite radar is going off here.
Amazing. I think humor, to be honest, you know, I've noticed, like, I went to a therapist a number of years ago, a holistic therapist, who's such a lovely guy. And we were talking about all the stuff that I've been through and how I needed to like bring unconscious stuff back into conscious light and da da da. And he said this thing one day, he goes, sometimes, he goes, you're just a bit hungry or you're just a bit tired. And I was like, that is amazing. That's like almost as good as 10 volumes of philosophy. It's like, wow, you know. Yeah. And I tell you what, he's so right, because, you know, if I do have that point in the day when I notice my brain starting, you know, it's guarantee you that I'm a bit hungry or a bit tired, because in my normal disposition, day to day, Leon, it just, I don't go there. And then when the ego kicks in, it's kind of comical. And I'm like, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, thanks for that. You know, and I'll laugh, and the intensity and the viciousness of it is just comical. It's like, wow, okay, you want to speak about it like that, do you? And you know, there will obviously be times where you do get consumed, and but I just think of Bill Thetford, and just think, you know, he sort of described it to us, didn't he, by saying, how small can you make that interval between getting back on the good foot?
Yeah, that's true. You know, in 12-step groups, there's that expression, the acronym HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. It's like, if you're any, just if you're one of those things, it's like a, you know, warning. And then if you're two, it's like, holy cow, you're going to be like Wreck-It Ralph, and you're just going to be smashing and just be like, ah. And so it's like, I always think of that too. It's like, yeah, maybe I'm just hungry. It's like, why do I have to read like a 12-chapter philosophy book about this? You know, I don't need something more profound.
So true.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hungry, Leon, tell us what your favorite comfort food is.
Oh, well, so there was a pet name for me with my mum and dad when I was a little toddler, and it was Mag. And Mag was an abbreviation for maggot. And apparently this maggot would open the fridge, and despite the size of the block of cheese that was in there, he would polish it off, whether it was small or large. And what then ensued was a period of time of trying to use sellotape to shut the door so this little maggot couldn't get in there until that was worked out and got past that. And then I believe they used to change the orientation of the fridge so it was butting up against something, so the door wasn't easy to open for a small child. And I have to say that love of cheese has never left me. I did try and be vegan once, but we were touring, and I was something like 16 countries in 30 days. And by country number two, I realized that if I was to continue with this veganism, which was probably only like a 3-month sort of soiree, I was going to be on bread and water for the next 30 days. So that resulted in a nice big pizza in Paris. And I was back on the cheese mobile. And to this day, yeah, many, many different types of cheese. I did have the cultural adjustment to make of moving from the north of England to the south of England and finding there's different cheeses. But that's a distant memory now. I could still go for therapy over that, but I think I'm through it now. It's sort of 40
what do you like? Now. Like a mature cheddar, or what's your go-to? Is that it?
Yeah. I love a mature cheddar, but then the part of England where I initially was from, Cheshire, they've got their own crumbly white cheese and red Leicester. I like a Welsh goat's cheese. It's probably a long list. Wensleydale cheese with little cranberries in it. And then there's cheese where they put chili in. It's like cheese party.
Wait, I feel like I'm feeling your truth frequency right here. I think there's a song of you just describing cheeses.
Really? I want to know what an immature cheddar is.
Childish.
A childish cheddar. Yeah. I would love a childish cheddar.
You've got to learn to say it first.
You have to do it with a Cheshire smile or a Cheshire cat.
A Cheshire cat wants a
childish cheddar.
Yeah, there you go. That's for a vocal coach.
Yes, with a little chatter thrown in.
Do you pair it with like pears or apples or anything, Leon, or is it just by itself?
You are so deep in, Matt.
I know. I was just.
We need to color this in fully for Matt. We're talking about food now. We got past all the core stuff. We're onto the serious, deep stuff.
Yeah.
What did I have?
You know, at some point, we should have a gathering of everyone who's come to the podcast, and they should each bring their comfort food. And we'll all go surprise Matt wherever he is in the world.
Wow. Yeah.
The podcast buffet.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's a great idea. Hey, well, I guess I could go on here for a while, as you can see, Leon. This is a great place to stop. But thanks so much for coming on Miracle Voices and sharing your miracle voice. Yeah. Tell us where we can find Warm Rain and also about your podcast or any place else you'd like to share.
Thank you. I'd love to. So, yeah, Warm Rain, obviously, you can find Warm Rain on Facebook, Warm Rain Official. They're on Instagram as Warm Rain Band. YouTube is the Warm Rain Official channel. Twitter is Warm Rain. And there's a website, warmrain.band, which is really interesting. It's got lots of depth and detail about the concept album. And then aside from that, we've got Leon Joel Russell, ACIM. That's the YouTube channel. And the podcast is called May the Course Be With You. Great. And I also use Twitter. So that's Leon Joel Russell, ACIM. And then on Facebook, I've also started a page just called May the Course Be With You. But if anybody wants to get in touch and talk about anything, that's lovely. And anybody wants to be on the podcast, it doesn't necessarily strike me as something that I think I need to have scholars or teachers. I think everybody's story is in fact, true to what you guys do. Everybody's story is of equal worth. So, yeah, please get in touch. And if you want to listen to Warm Rain, do so. See if it speaks to you. If you're suffering from loss, go to the Absent Friends scale of things. And if you're not and you just want to feel the joy, then I'd suggest Flying Dreams.
Thanks so much, Leon. What a wonderful episode. We really appreciate it. Yeah. Thanks. Have a wonderful weekend and enjoy the rest of the summer in Brighton.
Thank you so much, guys. Much
and some great cheese.
Yes.
Don't cheesy put any back cheese. Onto food.
Yeah, I know. What
I'm
are you
sorry,
doing,
I wanted
Tam?
To end this on cheesy cheese so that we can all...
Playing with fire here.
Okay. No, I'm playing with cheese.
Thanks so much for listening today. Please subscribe to Miracle Voices by hitting the subscribe button on your podcast app. If you are enjoying these conversations, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use. And lastly, please visit us at miraclevoices.org and join our newsletter so we can stay connected. Until the next podcast, I want to leave you with my favorite course quote, "When you want only love, you will see nothing else."